My name is Stephen Voltz. I'm here this week teaching about African Christianity. Just a little bit about my background. I've been to Holden a number of times over the years, over the last 30 years. Mostly, though, digging ditches and splitting wood as a maverick. So now I'm here on teaching staff, which is a nice change of pace. It's a sweet gig. You just teach a few lessons. Get pretty important. So my training is in African history. I got my PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I've been teaching now in the history department at Kenyon College in Ohio for the last 15 years. So my training is as a historian of Africa, but my focus of my research has often been, well, has mostly been on the history of Christianity, and specifically in Southern Africa among the Tswana-speaking people. And then more broadly, as I say, my research might be on sort of African responses to colonialism and Christianity in Southern Africa. But in my teaching, being at a small liberal arts college, I'm, as I say, responsible for the whole continent. And so in my teaching interests, my interests are much broader than that, for the whole continent of Africa. So I thought for Holden, what would be an interesting topic, I thought with this kind of this general topic of African Christianity, which obviously is a huge topic, encompassing lots of things. And so I chose, well, three sort of subtopics that might be of pretty good interest to Holdenites. First one on yesterday that I spoke about was on Bible translation. How is it that the Bible is translated into African languages? What were some of the challenges of doing so? And then in the process of doing so, how did Christianity become somewhat Africanized in terms of choosing African words for various concepts of Christianity? And at the same time, how were Africans Christianized by that process? So then today, the topic is religious authority and imperialism. Basically, I'll spend part of the time talking about the colonial period and how Africans asserted control over Christian churches and made a differentiation between European culture and Christianity and began to assert control over them. But then at the same time, then also spend a significant amount of time talking about more recent events and recent situations, particularly in the news, as I imagine most of you are aware, particularly in the issues of gender and sexuality. African churches are, many of them are taking a very divergent, conflicting view of that, of those issues than American churches, and have very much become a force in and have influenced events in the United States, with most prominently with the United Methodist Church, which is rapidly becoming the disunited Methodist Church, because the meeting that they had was dominated by sort of global South, and most prominently by African Methodists who felt differently about things and voted in ways that the North Americans did not. And then also in the Episcopal Church in the United States, Episcopal churches that have disagreed with the teachings or the rulings of the National Episcopal Church body, some of them have left and have joined the Anglican diocese of certain churches in Africa with whom they feel they have a closer proximity in terms of beliefs and doctrines. And so clearly, just in those two cases, African churches are sort of asserting their control not over churches in Africa, but their influence is spreading beyond the shores of Africa. So I want to include some discussion on that as well. Before I get into discussion on that, I'm just curious, I mean, it's my impression, and just talking to people at Holden, that quite a few people have some experience in Africa, oftentimes with synod, sister-congregation relationships or mission trips or what have you. So maybe to give me a better sense of who my audience is, does anyone here have some experiences either in Africa or maybe hosting Africans, or I guess?
My church in Andover, Minnesota, it's in Anoka, but it's Zion Lutheran. Mm-hmm. We support a minister from the Sudan.
Oh, okay.
And he became a ELCA pastor. Mm-hmm. It started out that they worshipped in our church. Mm-hmm. He's from the Sudan, but then he became an ELCA pastor. Mm-hmm. And we are helping support. We help build, along with other churches, a church building and also a hospital. But he's been to our church and told us what's going on. A very difficult area.
Oh, okay, so he's based in Sudan then. But he's come to visit here, and
he comes to our church. Yeah.
Oh, okay, great.
With his family.
I don't know, any other connections or? Yeah.
I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, southeastern Minnesota, and it has a connection both with South Sudan and Tanzania.
Oh, okay.
So our work has been shared work, building schools and hospitals and that kind of thing. Okay. I've never traveled to Africa, but I have professional colleagues in South Africa, as well as Botswana through an international organization that I'm part of. And I'm fascinated by their experience as well. So, yeah.
But have some members of your congregation then visited to gone to Tanzania?
Yeah.
Or?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. In support of those projects.
Right.
Yeah.
I do come from the Abbas area, and the Abbas area Synod has about 12 congregations that are either not speaking English or are made up of people that are coming from another culture. Mm-hmm. They also started a program some years ago, which is no longer strong, but still a little bit long, called the Agora Ministries. Agora mm-hmm. Ministries was a leadership training school, something like the Lutheran Bible Institute. It was trained for people that felt called in ministry from these other cultures and lived with us. In other words, they lived in Minneapolis, and we would provide teaching for them, and so that they might lead the congregation. Mm-hmm. That's partly by the frustration that those of us who don't know the language or the culture, we're not very effective at evangelizing those people into our congregations.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one question I might ask to kind of introduce this topic and some of the questions is, I mean, in whatever interactions you've had with Africa, I mean, how would you characterize the relationship between your churches or North American churches and African churches? Does one side seem to be in greater control of the situation, or does one influence the other? Which way does influence run more, or is it an equal exchange in terms of ideas and resources, or?
Partly you have to answer your question, you have to understand, are we talking about trying to meld the congregations of Africans and Americans, or are we talking about hosting, as your church in Zion was, hosting a congregation of a different culture, and in fact being two congregations, but both may be claiming to be Lutheran, but they're in the middle.
Okay, yeah, actually my mom is a member of a church in St. Paul, where there's an Ethiopian congregation using the same building space. And it's hard to say what the relationship is, because they, I mean, for better or for worse, are kind of parallel and haven't done a lot of interaction. But I guess the American congregation, if you will, owns the building, and so maybe there's a landlord relationship of some kind.
I have a neighbor that lives across from me from Ethiopia, but she's the Orthodox. She talks about the Lutherans, but she has a brother or somebody who's Lutheran, but she's Orthodox. Mm-hmm. And it's been really interesting to hear her tell about the country. Yeah. She had me over for their coffee, and we take it from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's where the home of coffee.
Yeah, right. And I learned a lot about the history. Like, of course, Christianity, did it begin, it start, like, in Ethiopia?
Well, it became established in Ethiopia before most of Western Europe.
Yeah.
So, again, that's...
And she talked about the influence of Italy.
During the colonial period.
And Ethiopia. And she's very religious. Fasting and the difference in Lutheran. I mean, when somebody dies, too, they have to bury them right away. And, just little things I learned a lot from her about the religious practices there.
Yeah, I think there's now more Lutherans in Ethiopia than there are in the United States. Even though the dominant Christian religion there is Orthodox, or Coptic. All right, well, we'll get back to this question of influence, because that's sort of the theme for today, is trying to look at how Africans resisted foreign influence. And I guess ultimately, when we talk about the contentious issue of gender and sexuality, are North American efforts to influence African ideas a form of neocolonialism? Mm-hmm. Who decides what is the right way to do Christianity? And does there need to be one right way to do Christianity, or to interpret the gospel? So just to kind of give you an overview here, the other thing, the general reason why I think this is significant, not just for Africans, but for any Christian in the world, is there's a trend. I mean, you can see by this Pew Research Center graph here in 2010, Europe has been kind of precipitous decline of number of people who self-identify as Christian and who attend regularly. It's probably even lower than that. By 2010, less than 26% of the world's Christians were European. About 25% Latin American, Middle East, very low, Asia Pacific, 30%. North America is kind of a gradual decline, down to 12% in 2010. But in Africa, it was 24%, so roughly about the same as Europe and Latin America, but all predictions are that it's going to continue to rise quite rapidly, such that it will become the the most, as it were, most Christian continent in the world.
Yeah. So why do you think the decline in Europe is so drastic there?
Well, I don't know. Anyone else have thoughts on that?
It has to do with the state church and what you consider a member or not.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And what's happening is that, like in my culture, in Norway, Sweden's disestablished right. themselves, so they have no state church. So suddenly, when they were already listed as members of the church under the old system, now they got to join the church and make it a personal decision, and not just because they're baptized. And that was sort of the.
And I guess I would add just to the more the general cultural change there. I mean, post Enlightenment, post French Revolution, that there's just been this. And gradual, the pace of secularization there is much faster than in the United States, I would say. Mm-hmm. What's happening now with mainstream Protestant churches in the United States is kind of declining, is sort of an echo of what has been happening in Europe for the past 30 years.
It also just seems growth trends in these various
places. Well, yeah, population growth. Well. Yeah,
this is percentage overall at its
yes,
time.
Right. You're right. Yeah, so it's, some of it is a reflection of the population growth in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's the children of Christian who are... Christians who are explaining some of that growth. But still, I mean, overall, I guess my assertion is that what makes African Christianity significant is increasingly, if we want to talk about what Christianity is, we have to look to Africa because, the center of gravity, as it were, is moving from Europe to Africa. I mean, there's still this...
It has moved,
yes. Yeah, and clearly, in the case of the United Methodist Church, and so then just a little bit on kind of overview of Africa. I mean, here's a map of the continent. I mean, I sort of have this habit, anytime I start any sort of lecture on Africa, I have to sort of explain that Africa is not one place. It is not one country. It is very large, very diverse. It's about a fourth of the world's land area, about a fourth of the world's countries are African. Of the world's 6,000 languages, about 2,000 are African, so a third of the world's languages are African languages. Here gives you a sense of the size, and there's the state of Washington to scale. The country of what's here was once the Belgian Congo colony, is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has the same land area as the United States east of the Mississippi River, or all of Western Europe. So somebody says, "What do you speak African, or who's the president of Africa?" And get or misunderstanding how large and diverse the continent really is. I don't know if I need to say anything else about that. The reason I showed this map is because it's relevant to the topic, at least the first part of the session, in talking about the colonial period. So just a brief overview, a glimpse of which European countries colonized which regions of Africa, with the French, I guess I don't have the key here, but the French is this colored area, it's mostly in West Africa and Central Africa, the British being red stripes, and then kind of dash them here because South Africa, essentially had self-rule, even though they were a British dominion, if you will. So the red stripes are British, and then the Portuguese are the gray stripes, and then Belgian Congo just was the only Belgian one, Italian over there. Ethiopia independent for most of the period, but then ultimately was conquered by Italy early in World War II, and so on. So you can see here. So in conjunction with this. Different European powers, also are different European mission societies. So that also influences which areas ended up getting which denominations. I mean, as you might be already aware, Tanzania, Namibia had a lot of Lutherans, largely because they were colonized by Germans. And the main mission societies operating there were German Lutherans. So similarly, Belgian Congo, the Roman Catholic Church was more influential in other French colonized areas, and so on. Rather than giving the whole history of colonialism, I thought I'd go straight to the main point is that, okay, now with colonialism, well, just to say, I mean, to briefly review something I said on yesterday's class, was, the European missionary activity really preceded colonial conquest. I think some people tend to conflate the two together, but European missionaries were operating for several decades before kind of European administrators and colonial armies moved in, so that by the time this so-called scramble for Africa took place between 1870 and 1910, there was already in many parts of Africa second, third generation African Christians. And so what happens is, as the Europeans come in to pose control, basically the attitudes of the missionaries tend to go in line with the colonialism. And so there's this increasingly strict regulation of African Christianity, along with, you know, general colonization of Africa. And so what happens, especially starting in the 1880s, 1890s, is a lot of these African Christians, who prior to the time had sort of embraced this egalitarian vision of Christianity, this idea that we're all God's children, we are one in the body of Christ, and we're used to being treated as equals, for the most part, by European missionaries, now suddenly are being treated as second class, and is not quite deserving equal treatment. And this was reflected in the churches, in that, you know, the Africans were expecting to kind of make the transition from missions to churches, and suddenly now the European missionaries in the 1880s and 1890s were like, well, not so fast. We think you need European supervision a little longer before you sort of earned the right to control your own churches. We're not going to ordain you so quickly as you may have expected or wanted. And so one of the responses to that was... I didn't show this slide. Well, this is to show you that, to go with what I said with colonization, but yeah, Protestant denominations are dominant. And then I don't want to backtrack here. I was trying to show you some of this. I'll explain this in a second. But yeah, well, I can jump right into this. So here's Gabriel David. Most of my research has been in Southern Africa, and so some of my examples I'll draw more heavily from there. This was one of my favorites. I mean, my dissertation that I wrote and was turned into a book was on Africans, the Tswana-speaking Africans, who were the first people in their communities to become preachers and teachers. And this was one of them, Gabriel David. His father converted to Christianity and took on the baptismal Christian named David. And so then in Tswana culture, your second name is simply the name of your father or of your husband. But I thought it was interesting. This is in 1887, reflecting a pretty widespread attitude among African Christians. And he's talking about his fellow Africans, the majority of whom still were not Christian at that time. So he's basically saying, you know, that these missionary societies are relying on African helpers, African, you know, as he says, native catechists. Basically, it means, you know, African preachers and teachers. No European can be able to show them the door. Their minds are very much unsettled because of late disturbances, meaning European conquest. They do not trust a white man anymore. They plainly say the white men have eaten and swallowed up their lands. So this was published in a missionary-edited newspaper, so I think some of the missionaries were sympathetic with him. And yet I thought this photo was striking as well. It was a big group shot. It was like all the Anglican priests in South Africa got together and had a big meeting in Bloemfontein, and here was this lone black face and this, you know, whole crowd of white priests, and he's smiling. I don't know if he feels uncomfortable. It's hard to know. I'm curious what he was thinking, but yeah. Clearly this is one thing he was thinking, is not entirely happy with the situation, that he was the only one ordained at that time, and he's wondering, when are all of my fellow African preachers going to earn the same sort of a sense of authority? And so then this, finally, when push comes to shove, you do have then these African preachers administratively, institutionally break free. So you have the creation of some new churches. And in Southern Africa, this is they're sort of collectively, I thought I had an outline. Well, I've got it in my little handout here. This is something called Ethiopianism. I mean, what it is these Africans look to Ethiopia for inspiration. As you pointed out, Ethiopia was Christian, you know, centuries earlier without any sort of European missionaries. And arguably had more direct lines with Jerusalem and the roots of Christianity than Europe did. And so the Africans, you know, black Africans in South Africa, saw Ethiopia as sort of inspiration and as evidence, as proof that Africans could have a perfectly good understanding of the gospel and without being explained to them by Europeans. And so they called their churches Ethiopian, even though really they, you know, had nothing to do with Ethiopia, but they just were sort of proud of Ethiopia's accomplishments. So the Europeans and Africans sort of called this general phenomenon Ethiopianism. So a number of them churches, independent African churches, popped up. Some of them, the Africans would sort of seize control of the mission station and just say, okay, this is our church now, we built it anyways. In other cases, they would just sort of start their own institutions. And the Europeans weren't quite sure how to respond to this. The European colonial authorities were a little nervous. They thought, what is this? Are these this kind of anti-European agitation? Should we be concerned about this? Should we crack down on this and arrest people? Should we just consider it a church matter and not the responsibility of the government to worry about? So there's a variety of responses. And ultimately in South Africa, they sort of allowed them to proceed and decided it was just an internal church matter, and the government didn't care if those African-run churches all that much. Elsewhere, though, later, after 1910, 1915, 1920, then they became more nervous about it and started to think that these Africans, that these churches are part of an early independence movement. So they would start to arrest the Africans. So that's why I'm just going to show you the one of the more famous cases of this was John Chilembwe. And this is in what was at the time the colony of Nyasaland, a British colony. Today it's the independent country of Malawi. Early on, his parents were Christian, but they all sort of worked in these tea plantations in southern Malawi that had been set up by British settlers. And so he was exposed to sort of British colonialism pretty early on, part of his childhood. But then he met this one British Baptist minister named Joseph Booth, who was pretty radical for his time. He was much more sympathetic with the Africans and felt that the Europeans were wrong to colonize Africa, felt that colonialism, and he was a white British missionary. But he actually wrote a book called Africa for the Africans back around 1900. So he was sympathetic with the plight of Africans under colonialism and, in fact, helped to arrange for John Chilembwe to receive a college education in the United States. So John Chilembwe goes to the United States, attends a historically black college, and receives his diploma as well as some training in seminary, and then returns to Africa with the ambition to start his own church and with the support and sympathy of John Booth, as well as a few other whites. But most of the British settlers, as you can understand, are a little nervous about this. He creates this big church. Here he is, a picture of him conducting a baptismal ceremony, full immersion Baptist preacher. But quickly attracts a lot of followers. I mean, his church becomes quite large and with lots of followers and prosperous. And so then he kind of poses a threat to the missionaries in their own kind of controlled churches. And then this rapidly becomes politicized with the beginning of World War I. Because we tend to think of World War I as something that took place in Europe, with trench warfare and all quiet on the Western Front and so on. But actually, it also affected Africa because there was also warfare, between Malawi, Nyasaland, a British colony, was adjacent to Tanganyika, the German colony. And there was warfare along the border. But who fought most of that warfare were, in fact, African conscripts. So Africans are drafted to fight against these other Africans who were commanded by, German officers on that side, British officers on this side. And so, as you can imagine, these Africans thought, this is not our war. We don't like it. So John Chilembwe, even though he's just a minister, a Baptist minister, he wrote a letter to the newspaper. And this is an excerpt from it. So he's basically addressing the British settlers and expressing what he thinks about World War I. Mm-hmm. I don't need to read it out loud. You can read it here. So I don't know. Responses to this? Maybe it is political. Is he calling for revolution here? Or?
To me, he's just speaking the truth. it's part of colonization, I think. Keeping the power.
Yeah. Speaking truth to power, as it were.
And instead of digging up the riches, they're using blacks to kill other blacks to maintain who's going to win.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to know if this is one small example and many others, but just the way you tell the story, it's pitting England and Germany, but then he has this experience in a historically black college just the complexity then of colonialism and of enslavement becomes even more complicated to try to navigate.
No, you're right.
What's actually being fought about in this?
Well, you're right. I mean, I think his experience in the United States is a formative part of all this as well, because he has direct experience of kind of Jim Crow segregation. And that has a big influence on his understanding of what it means to be African, because he sees this kind of idea of the larger sort of black identity and sees white people kind of as this collective group.
There's one part of this that I have a little heartache, and it says, are invited to die for a cause which is not theirs.
Right, he's clearly being a little sarcastic, rather bitter in his tone. Right, let the rich man banker tell him, let them go and get shot.
Yeah.
He's clearly very angry here. You know, his people in his community who have gone and been killed and left widows and orphans. And but I thought also his appeal to Almighty God, suggesting that, God must not approve of this either. That, Europeans up to this point, part of their justification for colonialism is that they're bringing the light of civilization and Christianity to the heathens, the savages. And he's sort of turning that and saying, wait a second, your behavior here is clearly not that of Christian, charity.
Mm-hmm.
And that you guys have sort of lost, Europeans have lost the moral high ground here, and that Africans have a better claim to that. Well, within a few weeks of this letter being published, the European colonial authorities, sort of go to investigate what's going on, but it tends to escalate rapidly. And so some people, Africans who see this are all fired up and say, yeah, this is wrong. And so in fact, a rebellion breaks out. And so some people in this kind of tea plantation area in southern Malawi. And so Chalamba himself is not calling for it, but people are sort of citing his name in their movement. And so he is sort of identified by the Europeans as the ringleader, even though he himself is not wielding any weapons. And there are only a few settlers who are killed, but there's a rapid police response from the colonial troops. John Chalembwe fears for his life, rightly so, and tries to escape and is killed in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very kind of short-lived rebellion. It was not very well organized. It was very spontaneous. It was just essentially a few dozen workers in the tea plantations nearby to Chalembwe's church who conducted this rebellion, but it had kind of a reverberation throughout Malawi and throughout southern Africa. It showed here, but actually one of the denominations of the Malawi currency, banknotes today, has Chalembwe's picture on it.
Mm-hmm.
So they regarded him as kind of an early inspirational figure for independence. This is what happens to Chalembwe's church. There's the colonial troops, posing in front, and then after they've, hit it with artillery and kind of reduced it to rubble. It was a pretty impressive church.
Yeah.
And built just with donations from the tea plantation workers. And so it's obviously a shame. Not sure I'm not forgetting anything here. All right. Yeah. I don't know, questions, comments about Chalembwe?
Certainly demonstrates the power of words and how the words were received differently by people who seem to need to hear it, to move to something, but I'm certain they didn't understand that their movement would, incite this backlash. Mm. But words are powerful.
Oh, yeah.
And even though he didn't intend them necessarily to incite anything, the cautionary tale there is probably being careful, but also he spoke his truth. I mean,
right.
Let the government settle the problem.
and their position, rightfully anger, it's like, how do you express that if you're going to provoke this violent backlash?
Yeah.
I'm struck at how similar this is to the story of Martin Luther King.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King came late to the decision. Mm-hmm. He was against the Vietnam War, but his reason for it was the system of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
A quarter of the number of black people, people of color, were going there and being killed. Mm-hmm. While rich people, like Trump, got out of it because of
right.
his business. So, Martin Luther King, in his own life, finally made connection with the African leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And met South African black leaders. They had a lot of kind of
Criticizing the war and getting accused of being unpatriotic for it. So I'm going to move on to one other case of this kind of colonial, well, actually, then one after this, William Wade Harris, I just wanted to include one case from French West Africa. And it's interesting because it's slightly different than John Chilembwe's career. He was from Liberia, grew up there, was exposed to sort of Christianity from the African-American settlers in the area. Early on was a member, I think he started out Methodist and then became Episcopalian. Did not visit the United States, so he didn't have that cultural influence. But was influenced in some ways by Islam, at least in terms of the dress, but also by traditional healers. And I guess what makes him distinctive is that he's still today admired and respected by people in Liberia and Ivory Coast and Guinea, Sierra Leone, Guinea as well, was for the way he saw sort of Christianity in African terms, that he really, I mean, he used some symbols and some language of sort of traditional healing, and a sort of some of the other beliefs about spirits, and he basically, he portrayed Christianity as a war between good and evil, that God would protect people from witchcraft, and he really sort of explained Christianity in terms that resonated with indigenous African beliefs, in such a way he became very popular. But he did so completely independently of the missions, and so that's what made him sort of a challenge, because these missionaries, they would hear, oh, have you heard Harris? He's preaching. This prophet has come. He saw himself as a modern-day Elijah, but did so completely independently of any sort of training or association with the European missionaries. And so they sort of resented his success. It's estimated that he baptized more than 100,000 people over his career, and he made multiple pilgrimages back and forth throughout French West Africa. Unfortunately, he died penniless back in Liberia, never made any money from his sort of self-declared, career as a prophet. But today he's still credited with sort of inspiring a lot of other independent African churches, and who felt that given his success and his sort of commitment and dedication to this idea of sort of a local indigenous African Christianity, that they could do the same thing. So he lived mostly during the 20s is when he was operating. Yeah.
That's very interesting to me because Ireland was a little bit that way because the empire didn't ever really get there. Mm-hmm. And it was Christianized on top of
The Celtic beliefs.
And so they absorbed all those practices and became their own version of that. And
thus we have Christmas celebrations today.
Yeah, so it's like really interesting to see that somebody had some success with keeping the empire at bay.
Yeah, and it wasn't so much because he didn't ever really directly challenge colonial rule, he just ignored it basically, and operated only in the rural areas, and never really questioned European authority, but just felt it was inconsequential. I mean, he wasn't on tea plantations and stuff, so he didn't have the direct influence that Chilembwe experienced. So now this one, and this kind of now leads me into sort of more contemporary, more current events. This one, I think you might find a little more problematic or contentious, is the case of the Kikuyu churches during the 1920s. Just a little bit of background here. I mean, Kenya, this is a map kind of trying to illustrate the British colonization of what's today Kenya. Was briefly sort of British East Africa. I'm not going to explain all of the symbols and dates on here, but just to focus on specifically the so-called White Highlands. Those are the areas of central Kenya that were higher in elevation and therefore less afflicted by malaria and other tropical diseases and more fertile land. And so British settlers settled there in large numbers, similarly to southern Malawi. But the Africans who were living in those areas were mostly Kikuyu-speaking people. And so they were somewhat displaced by British colonization. And then sort of the responses to missionary activity kind of varied. But many of them actually did work with the missions and became Christian. What makes it independent, I mean, the independency movement, it was mostly Anglican and Presbyterian mission agencies. Oh, and that's what this then shows you is some of the, where the mission stations, you'll find there was a cluster of them in the more fertile sort of central highlands of Kenya. So that's where the missionaries wanted to be too, because it was more scenic and also the least disease-ridden. So this shows you it was predominantly Protestant, and not just Protestant, but Anglican and Presbyterian. So then what happens, I don't know if I have any, okay, I'll get to that. Well, I can show it here. So what happens in the 1920s is the missionaries, and this now, I mean, I imagine you've heard of female genital mutilation in some parts of Africa. I guess to be less judgmental, you might call it female initiation or female circumcision. And this now comes to the, well, what happened in the 1920s, basically, well, maybe I should first say, what are we talking about? Within Kikuyu culture, actually, sorry, should have put this up there sooner. I talked more about this yesterday, so I'm not going to repeat everything I said, but this is a come on, where did my arrow go? This is a map of African language. Oops, oh, you're out of it, seen it. Never mind. I don't know how to get rid of that. Now what? Oh, there we go. This is a map of showing you different African languages, but I just wanted to show you that this practice is mostly associated with people who speak Nilo-Saharan languages, which is the purple color, as well as to some of these Afro-Asiatic or Cushitic languages, which is some of these kind of grayish-green. So it's important to start off by saying that this is not a continent-wide custom, that it's very much confined to a few cultural groups, and it's most prominent, most prevalent among the Nilo-Saharan-speaking peoples or adjacent groups, kind of, so you can see, you know, where it's most common, as well as some of the Afro-Asiatic groups. I won't explain what I mean by those linguistic terms now, but now I have to get back to my PowerPoint. Actually, I just done this to start. What are you doing? Does anyone know?
I ask myself every day I'm on.
I think I'm going to do it this way. All right. So what it is as this is common across African cultures to have initiation rites. When children, in order to enter adulthood, they have to pass through various ceremonies as well as pretty intensive education and initiation rites. Oftentimes, they'll be sort of isolated from the rest of the community for several weeks or even more than a month. And during that time, the elders will come and basically train them in what are your responsibilities and duties as an adult, what does it mean to be a responsible parent, what does it mean to be a citizen of the community. So it's this whole kind of intensive a curriculum in how to sort of earn the right to be a full-fledged member of the community. And some of that initiation also often included sort of feats of physical endurance. It might include fasting, it might include staying awake several nights in a row. In the case of boys, it would include often in many of these societies circumcision. In the case of girls, in a few of these societies, as I pointed out, it would include more critically is known as female genital mutilation, less critically female circumcision, but it does involve some amount of cutting on the female genitalia. But it varies how much, quite a bit from one society to the other, whether it's just a pinprick to draw blood or whether it's more extensive and horrendous than that. So what happens in this case, the Kikuyu-speaking peoples, members of these churches, fairly successful, the missionaries decided in the 1920s that this practice is barbaric. It's dangerous, it's disempowering to women. In the worst cases, and I think in the Kikuyu it was more drastic sort of circumcision or mutilation in that it did it made it more difficult for women to give birth. It made it sort of made it more difficult for them to enjoy sex. I mean, in various ways, the Europeans were just appalled by this practice and thought that this is something that members of the Christian mission should stop. So now it might surprise you, I've been sort of building up on this African independence and cheering on the Africans. Well, a lot of the Africans resisted that. They said, they felt, I mean, for a number of reasons, that this was part of their understanding of Christianity. One way, referencing yesterday's session of Bible translation, I think it was an unintended consequence. Basically, they said, well, wait a second, Mary herself was circumcised. And the missionaries are like, what are you talking about? Well, the word the missionaries found, the closest word in Kikuyu for Virgin Mary, is a female who is no longer adolescent, has now become an adult, but is not yet married. In other words, it's the exact word in Kikuyu for someone who's gone through initiation rites, but is not yet married, not yet had a first child. And so they're saying, you're using that word. So they didn't have the word virgin, they had the word for this other word. So they're saying Mary herself went through initiation rites. And then they had another brother argument and said, well, ultimately it came down to mostly about kind of divisions within the Kikuyu church. Some people in the rural areas sort of resented the more centralized, more prosperous missions and congregations telling them what to do. And it ultimately came down to, as well, to sort of resentment of Europeans telling them what to do. And so a bunch of these churches broke away from the Anglican and Presbyterian missions, established their own Kikuyu churches so that they could continue these initiation rites and see for female circumcision. But it raises, I think, there's echoes of this, I think, today in terms of, well, we want to respect African control over to define Christianity, how they see it, and as it fits in their culture. At the same time, what happens if some of their beliefs or practices seem, from our perspective, to clearly contravene Christian teachings?
That picture taken?
I think later, like probably the 1940s or 50s.
Oh, okay. I went on a mission to Haiti, and that looks just like the school in Haiti.
It's like the European,
What age are they?
A range in ages.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you can see there are some girls as well in there.
Okay.
It's all teenagers, but predominantly boys. And then this is a picture. This is Kikuyu girls initiation. That's what I was trying to find. So they all, an age group, as they call it, a group of girls who are all roughly the same age, and then boys similarly, would go through this initiation together, and then the rest of their life, they would.
Well, the women here are in their traditional dress, but there's a distinction there of the boys in uniform.
Well, this. Yeah, I mean, it's just different settings. I mean, if I showed you a picture of boys in initiation class, they would also be dressed in African.
Oh, okay.
I was just contrasting a mission school with initiation school, as it were.
Okay.
And I should add, too, I mean, another objection that the Kikuyu would have is not just citing the Virgin Mary, but initiation was such an ingrained part of their culture, I think, in some ways it would be comparable if some outsider came to the United States and said, okay, girls can no longer get high school diplomas.
Rebellion.
So they saw it as disempowering to women, the idea of ending initiation rites, rather than, they saw it as a way that, wait a second, you're telling us that our girls can never become adults? I mean, this isn't, so they saw initiation rites as empowering, not as disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously they would have to change the way the whole debate is framed in order to persuade it. As it is now, I mean, I should bring it up to the present day with female genital mutilation, that increasingly, I mean, Africans themselves are realizing, if nothing else, the health risks of this, and are changing the practices to make it less severe. And I should say, in Southern Africa and most of Africa, you don't have any of this, so. So I think it is changing. Has anyone seen the film Mulade? Maybe not. Well, if you're more interested in learning more about this, it's Ousmane Sembène. He's a Senegalese director. I think it was his last film, Moolade. Yeah, I'm sure it's on Netflix. But it's basically, he talks about how a community in West Africa is divided over this issue. How this one woman refuses to send her girls to the initiation and to be circumcised, and the community is appalled by this, and there's this big showdown between kind of the traditionalists and the modernizers, and the director is very sympathetic with the modernizers, but I think he does it a very effective job of respectfully sort of looking at this as a West African director.
Could you repeat the spelling?
Oh, the spelling, yeah. M O O L A D E. Actually, it might be two A's. Now that I think about it, M O O L A A D E.
Thank you.
If that doesn't come up, the director's last name is Sembène. It's spelled S-E-M-B-E-N-E.
Thank you.
Sembène. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's two O's and two A's. Moolade. All right. So, are there any questions, comments about this controversy and whether the missionaries were imposing their will? All right, well, then let's move to the recent relations and sort of bring it up to a much more recent contentious issue. Obviously, recent relations between African and European European American churches. I mean, I want to include some more positive relations, but I thought, well, I'll start with the elephant in the room, as it were, and just the cultural differences between many African societies and in the United States and Europe. I mean, one clear difference here, I'll be patriarchy versus gender equality. I think, you know, I can maybe reference my sister, Catherine, is actually a bishop of the ELCA's Northern Great Lakes Synod. And I had the opportunity to travel with her when they visited their sister synod in Tanzania. And while my sister was, you know, received respectfully and the warmest welcome, yeah, she did notice a little bit of, you know, distance, or, you know, she just felt that as a woman bishop, she was not treated quite the same way as a male bishop, as the previous, because her predecessor was male, people in authority generally in many parts of Africa are predominantly male, not female. I mean, women exercise power in other parts of their life, but in kind of public figures in many parts of Africa are predominantly male. Patriarchy is, you know, while as entrenched as it is in the United States, it's even more entrenched in most of Africa. And so this becomes, I think, an area of sort of cultural friction, arguably, between African Christian churches and American Christian churches, in terms of, you know, what kind of roles women should have in the church, and so on. I think another cultural difference, I would say, I mean, emphasis on family and duty versus individual rights, and maybe, and there's some sort of previewing this. I mean, well, let me, I guess, to illustrate this, I'll give you a story. Just last month, I was in Botswana for a couple of weeks, and while I was there, their Supreme Court ruled, much to many people's surprise, that a law that had been on the books for a long time in Botswana, a law basically that had criminalized sex between consenting adults of the same gender. It was against the law. I mean, I'm not sure that how often it was enforced, but still, the law was on the books, and so somebody took this to the, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court of Botswana. Supreme Court of Botswana ruled that, you know, no, this is unconstitutional, that you know, the government has no business interfering in this relationship. But what I found interesting then was people's reaction to this, because I was reading the newspapers, and how do people respond to this? There were several long editorials, articles, and sort of letters to the editor. And the way it was, I mean, so the way it was sort of, those people who were sympathetic with the decision and thought it's about time, generally, in their support, they didn't talk, they didn't think about it as sexuality as an identity. They didn't say that LGBT people should have this right. They were more talking about behavior. I mean, and even the Supreme Court itself, the language they used to defend it was privacy. They said that the government has no right saying what people should do in the privacy of their own bedroom between consenting adults. It wasn't about the rights of individuals, and it wasn't about identity of LGBT people, it was about LGBT behavior, if you will. So it's a very different way of sort of understanding it, different from American society. I mean, there were those who, I mean, like there was the Le Habibo, I mean, there's a group in Botswana that has long been agitating for this and is basically trying to defend it and promote protection for the rights of LGBT people, and it sort of frames it in terms of identity, but the majority didn't. And those who are critical of the decision, in criticizing it, there was some people who referenced Christianity and felt that this was, you know, that homosexuality was sinful and so forth. But more often, they framed it, they said this is against African culture. And that they felt that the Supreme Court was sort of capitulating to Western cultural influence. And they framed it in the terms that we saw, you know, during the colonial period, some of these debates were framed. That they felt that this was not part of African culture. So I'm not, I guess, not to support the African view, necessarily to condone it, but I guess I feel an important, you know, an urge to at least understand what was the motivation, you know, where is the thinking coming from? And so one way that I attribute this is this kind of different view of identity. I mean, if conventionally, historically, if you asked an African, who are you, they're not going to answer in terms of a race. They're not going to say, I am black. They're not going to answer in terms of sexual orientation. They're not even going to answer in terms of vocation. I am a teacher. They're going to answer, I am the son of, I am the mother of, I am the grandson of, I am the member of this family. It's all about the family. That individuality is really of secondary importance. And if somebody's going to say, my identity, my individualism, you know, is just who I am, don't tell me what to do, that would be very rude and very kind of unthinkable that somebody would put themselves ahead of their family. And so I think it's an important thing to understand that maybe it will still come, but maybe it's part of a cultural change. I think Africans who are more urbanized, who have lived, who are more educated, who have spent time traveling abroad, are more likely to have the same idea of identity as Westerners. But for the majority, I think they still think of themselves as members of a family, that you don't have individuals per se, that it's not about the rights of individuals to express themselves. It's a, it's that duty is more important. That, hey, you saw this actually just in Botswana the day after the Supreme Court thing. I actually met one of my former students who was from Botswana, but he came to my school, Kenyon College, and he was telling me this, in a way demonstrating this for me. He got a degree, a bachelor's degree in international studies, and was extraordinarily ambitious and bright, got a job, a better paying job than me, right out of school, for a diamond marketing firm, an international firm. So he was like spending time in New Delhi and Singapore and Antwerp and so on, selling diamonds, and was sort of learning on the job, making good money and very busy. But then his mom got suddenly sick and died while he was out of the country. And this just changed his whole worldview. He returned home. Suddenly, his two younger sisters, teenagers, had no breadwinner. The father was not in the picture at all. So suddenly, he became the sole breadwinner in this family. Not just sisters, but some cousins and nephews and nieces were looking to him. Hey, I got to pay my school fees. Hey, because his mom had a pretty good job working for a diamond company. And so he kind of went through this shift in his kind of worldview, because he had been sort of following this American dream of being this prosperous, jet-setting, individual with all kinds of wealth and power. And when he called, when I had lunch with him, he just said, no, he's much happier now, actually, but he also feels this kind of pressing responsibility. But it was just interesting to see how he was trying to reconcile what he had learned in his American liberal arts college education with his duties as a Botswana. In fact, he was even laughing because I had been the one to tell him about some customs. And so he was like, for the funeral, he had to go to his uncle's to get help arranging cattle for the funeral. And he had said he'd first heard about that custom from me. And so I said, yeah, but Professor Volt says I need to get some cattle. Yes. But anyways, for me, it's a demonstration of what I've seen again and again and again.
Do you have to bury their dead immediately, or
not? No, that's a Muslim custom, not in Botswana necessarily. Yeah.
Well, my neighbor, who's Ethiopian, when somebody died in Ethiopia, she's an Orthodox. She said they have to bury them.
That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, in terms of Ethiopia's proximity. Yeah. To the Red Sea, and there's a lot of cultural diffusion across that would explain that. So sexuality, so as much as this is contrary to American understandings of sexualized behavior versus his identity, I mean, it seems to me that is the common belief still in many parts of Africa. Yeah.
I'm just curious, are these conflicts different between the African Christian communities you're familiar with and the greater African community, or is this more of a, I guess, cultural, religious, I know they all combine,
what you've seen. So are you asking whether they cite Christian teachings when they make this decision, or this view, or?
Yeah, or just you see this play out within the Christian community and the African, or if there's some Christian versus other African communities in these debates.
No, I mean, there's a lot of divergence of opinion. Has anyone seen the documentary God Loves Uganda? It's kind of a controversial, I mean, it came out about maybe 10 years ago. I guess I haven't mentioned it yet because I don't necessarily agree with its point of view. But basically, it was some American filmmakers had visited Uganda and were shocked by the influence, in their opinion, that American sort of conservative evangelicals had in Uganda. And it was their assertion, and what they took portray in the film, is that Uganda's rather conservative views on sexuality, they attribute to this American influence. But along the way, they also interview an Anglican, mainstream Protestant Ugandan, who is actually more in line with American views. And so this is for them as a demonstration that, so within sort of Uganda, they say that sort of more Europeanized mainstream Protestant Ugandans are going to be more more in line with sort of the American and European understanding. And so they say even within Christianity in Africa, there's this division that it's more. But I guess in my experience in reading, I think to some extent they were projecting America's cultural divisions onto Africa and sort of going there expecting to find the exact same sort of political polarization there as we find in the United States. Mm-hmm. And ignoring the possibility and the likelihood that many Africans are defending their views not from sort of conservative Christian teachings, but from African culture. So no, there's a lot of variation in Botswana, in mid-parts of Africa. So it's hard to generalize as much as I am here. So that's, I guess, the last other point I would say, influenced by non-Africans and African views. So some people would argue that, you know, sort of right-wing conservative in the United States and elsewhere sort of influencing African views, but I guess I would, you know, entertain the possibility that the same thing is happening the other way. I mean, or that, you know, more liberal-minded Americans are also trying to influence African views. And I guess that's the big question I ask you. What do we make of this? How do we deal with the fact that, you know, like what happened at the United Methodist meeting, that so many Africans, you know, at that meeting, African Methodists voted to continue to regard homosexuality as a sin, that it was seen as a behavior that people have a choice about rather than as identity, you know, that it's a person who is, who they are. Yeah.
I'm a United Methodist pastor in Sacramento, and so just to clarify a little bit as well, the issue at the Special General Conference wasn't about necessarily sustaining the rules that were in place. It was about making stronger punishments for those of us that either are gay or lesbian and become ordained, or we marry gay and lesbian people.
Okay.
And so the issue became more of a punitive one rather than just can we live with different worldviews in different places. So I would just kind of challenge a little bit of the assumption of what happened there. And to me, the little story you shared about the student of yours is a really critical one to unpack for us in the sense that the dominant view in the United Methodist Church would say that it is the right wing of the United Methodist Church that has funded Christian mission to Africa. But what is actually the case in the United States is like 82% of United Methodists live in regions where our delegates are for inclusion. That's where the money is coming from Africa. So like there's all going to Africa. So the 99% of the funding of the United Methodist Church comes from the United States as well. So there's more complexity in terms of the finances of all this and how voting happens and growth and like what counts as a person, like a member. So I mean, all of these questions just become so overwhelming so fast.
Well, thank you, because I was hoping somebody else would know more about it than I do. So I'm glad you clarified.
Can I just ask?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. This, I have a lot of Methodist pastor friends. So, like, what's happening in your world right now with some of that?
Well, so we're on the, I'm in California, so we're in the West. And we've been marrying gay people since we said not to in 1972. Right. So there's been a group of people who have been kind of living out their sense of gospel values in that way. Mm-hmm. What's new now is that what I would describe as more moderates from the Midwest, our megachurch pastors, are saying, wait a second, it's one thing for me to say I'm only going to let the radical progressives do what they do on the side, and you're just going to say they shouldn't do it. But now if you want to kick them out of the church or tell me, like in these rules now, we should actually go to gay and lesbian families and tell them that they should divorce to be in compliance with this. So you have moderates now saying this isn't okay.
Right.
And so now you also, to stay with the colonialism issue, you have, like in the West, you have the first Mexican-American bishop in California. You have the first African-American female bishop in Southern California. So you have places where communities of color have been able to find representation, whereas in the Midwest, you don't have that. And so now you have these white evangelical pastors, moderates, ready to lead the charge, who've been silent for the last 35 years. So that's where I would say we are.
There's all kinds of
we're falling apart. But on a fundamental level, I do think it asks these questions of like, what unity in what way? Like when we talk about unity, how am I more united with the United Methodist community in the Congo than I am an ELCA church in Sacramento? And I don't know the answer to that, but that is a bizarre thing to try to make sense of.
That was it. I don't know, you guys were, I think it was maybe something that Chuck said last night. We were talking about, you know, this, maybe somebody was talking about the future of sort of mainstream Protestant in the United States, you know, whether the only sort of sustainable thing is to have a lot of mergers or somehow, or to sort of reconceive how to define these churches.
Something new has to rise.
But I would also just, one more thing, I would also say, like, our African-American churches, our Filipino churches, they are saying, look, we have a racist history and a history of enslavement that we also, we've been hanging in there with you guys for all of these years. We're not leaving over this issue. Now you are upset?
I guess the other thing that I might bring to this that I haven't talked about is, as much as some of these, some of the Africans who are sort of, you know, critical of you know, or you know, who are sort of towing the more conservative line and saying that this is part of African culture to have this attitude, I think there's a lot of evidence to push back against that too. I mean, there's been some research done showing you, I mean, it's so, in my opinion, so ubiquitous in the world. I mean, you have gender fluidity in every culture and multiple understandings of sexuality and roles. And I think the same is in most African cultures. I think it just hasn't received a lot of attention, and it's become so highly politicized now. That it, you know, that there isn't much support for that scholarship and that research, but I think it's there. It has to be there as well. And so it seems to me, if Africans are going to sort of come to some reconciled and in my opinion, you know, more Christian view of this, it's going to have to involve some serious, you know, soul searching and looking at their own society. But I think what happens is, like happened to Kikuyu, you know, think of the 1920s, is once people with wealth and power start coming in and trying to impose their view, then the immediate reaction is to push back and to adopt these views that are kind of nationalistic. And even if the other people are right, it's like, okay, if, you know, we don't want other people telling us what to do, even if we might agree with them in some ways. Yeah, any other thoughts? I mean, are other people to, I mean, anyone here Episcopalian or have thoughts on what's happening, African influence on that front?
So in the Methodist Church, then, can each church make its own decision about this problem? I mean, that they voted, or do you have to go along with the national?
I mean, we've had, since 1972, we've had a rule that says homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. And so, but I have done a lot, I mean, so, but we just don't, we don't care.
Because there hasn't been like official punishment for disobeying.
There has been in more conservative areas. So we're very much like a states' rights group. So like the Senate has a lot of power in that way. So we call it an annual conference. So if the annual conference, if I go to a trial among my peers, we would say like, oh yes, you're guilty of marrying that gay couple. You have one day of paid leave for your punishment.
Oh, okay.
So those are the ways that we've like, it's not unlike the person in there that you were naming that, it's like, what are these creative ways that you try to resist this to not necessarily challenge it
and
you face it slant. So. Oh,
interesting. Well, how can the day of paid leave be a punishment?
Well, it's not.
It's not.
But it counts to them as, it counts, it follows our rules. In that way, we try to follow the rules by the law.
Right. Well, that's the
punishment.
Law.
The letter of the law.
Right.
Yeah. Well, in like the Roman Catholic Church, you go in as, if you're a Protestant, you can't take communion. My husband was a Lutheran minister, and he helped officiate a friend of ours who got married in a kind of a Catholic church, but they were very liberal. And they told, you know, you can't have communion, but the priest said it's okay. So a whole bunch of us that were Lutheran, we went out and took communion. We thought, we're all Christian. We all believe the same God.
Right.
We took communion.
If you love God.
Yeah.
You
I think like, what's wrong with that?
So I was curious at the conference of the United Methodist Church, was there any, I mean, I don't know what kind of discussion there was. I mean, were there any Africans who, I mean, did they vote as a block, or was there some difference of opinion among them as well?
That's a huge question, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So And so there's also complexity, because when African delegates even come to be able to come to be part of General Conference costs thousands and thousands of dollars.
Right, and so
it's being funded, and then they arrive and Good News and various like right-wing groups greet them with cell phones. So part of the rumors are that African delegates are very much directed by the right in our church. How accurate those are, it's really hard to know whether that's just like our colonial read of they can't think for themselves, or if there is like
a legitimate or real influence. So then you say now it's just kind of all up in the air. Do you have any sense of what direction things might head next? Or?
No one really knows. I would say there's we're moving toward another one of these in Minneapolis. We'll be in Lutheran Mecca to fight this out in another year. So we'll do that in May. And so I think the hope is that we can have like amicable separation, divorce in either two or three denominations. Some people's hope. I'd say my hope. But I don't know that that'll happen, or it might just be that churches start to disaffiliate from it.
One by one, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, even in some of the ELCA Lutheran churches in Minneapolis or Minnesota, it's us up to the pastor, because at our church, I guess the church council, they were split, and they said, well, you can marry a gay person, but not in our congregation, in the church, outside the church. But others, it's different.
Depends
on the past.
Church.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense. Go ahead. Could we go to a little bit different subject that you asked about experience with Africans in the American church? We have a large group of the Romo people, these people from Ethiopia. And I was privileged to mentor the pastor and learn a lot from him. And this the synod was very pleased that they were there, and the synod he came from the Makano Jesus Church, which we have a lot of contact with, and so we did everything we could to find a place for them to worship, to find them some kind of funding, because they didn't have the money. But when it came down to the conversation I was having during this controversy we just talked about, they first of all, the pastor of the congregation says, I don't know what to do. He says, it's not just that I've got people that think this is wrong, but I've got a very strong lay-led church. Mm-hmm. And they would tell him what to preach and when to preach. I mean, he was partly realizing that even if he would try to say something about this in order to accept the position that all the rest of us in Minneapolis were taking, he didn't know if he had a future, but finally came to the president of this congregation, who I just loved, he's a wonderful man, but he came to me and said, tell me, is this a sin? Now, think about it, how would you answer that question? And I averted it. I mean, I said, I don't think the church has been clear on that at that time. And I said, I want you to know that we really want you in the Evangelicalism Church. They stayed, but one of the things that happened is they had a split in the congregation, and the Pentecostal portion basically was one that said we shouldn't affiliate at all with anything like this kind of policy. But even with all of that split, it's been the fastest growing congregation and one of the largest in our whole synod.
Right.
These people from Africa. This is not Norwegians now, folks. This is talking about something happening right in our country.
Right. So I think we come back to that. Why is Christianity growing so fast in Africa? I think we'll have time for that. Maybe we can run through. While this is clearly a point of major and consequential contention, I guess I'd like to also acknowledge the other areas of interaction between African and Euro-American churches. I mean, collaboration of social services projects. We've already talked about building schools, healthcare, health clinics, sending off anti-malaria nets and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of ways that American churches are trying to help on a very local, small-scale level, or on a larger level. I mean, Lutheran World Relief runs some of the biggest, most successful refugee camps in East Africa, in the Sudan and in Kenya. And I think that's also, I think, ultimately contributed to the Oromo adopting Lutheranism, because it's associated with these refugee camps. Worship and liturgy, I mean, is demonstrated even this week at her Vespers, singing African songs. And it obviously goes the other way. There's actually a little anecdote here as well. When I visit Botswana, I usually worship at a Lutheran church there, and they have a Setswana service at 8 o'clock and an English language service at 10. And I've gone to both, but I usually go more often to the English one. And it's interesting, the English one is attended almost, you know, by 3/4 of the people in attendance are actually Tanzanians who have moved to Botswana, businessmen or own trucking companies and whatever. So it's really interesting, but I'm always expecting, okay, Tanzanians, you know, in this Lutheran church in Botswana, that the service is going to be very lively. But I'm always, I mean, I have to, you know, I haven't really told them, I'm always a little disappointed because they have the LBWs in the racks and are teaching, you know, how great thou art. And, I mean, these are wonderful old American hymns with, like, and then I think the service becomes most interesting when they break into a Swahili hymn, because then it's, you know, Tanzanian tunes and harmonization. So I mention it now just because, I mean, this influence goes both directions. And, you know, most African churches have become more Africanized in their liturgy and in their music and so forth. And yet there's this lingering sort of fascination with German chorales that, you know, I can't quite explain. This is many of them translated into African languages. And the growth of Pentecostalism and gospel, well, this is something that will be the focus of all day tomorrow, I mean, the whole session tomorrow, because this is, I think, a big one as another sort of aspect of African Christianity. I think we can. I don't know if people had any questions about the comments I was making about identity or kind of these cultural differences, if that is clear.
Under the social service project, mm-hmm. After my husband died, he was a New Testament scholar, and we had all these books of his, and there's an organization in Minnesota mm-hmm. where we sent 35 boxes of his books to mm-hmm. Africa for seminaries and that. And I just thought that was unheard of. It was amazing.
Yeah.
35
boxes. So some of that can be good. Actually, I remember when I was in the Peace Corps in Botswana, I was teaching at a junior high school in a rural area. And during the first year there, we had no electricity or running water. And then the government of Botswana thankfully built some buildings, and we suddenly had a library, but it had no books. Mm-hmm. But then we got some donations, and some of them were from, I think, some place in Saskatchewan or some place in Canada. And I said, oh, great, boxes of books. I open them up, and it's like, you know, a three-volume set of Growing Wheat in Manitoba. I'm like, it's a book. It's shiny. It looks good on the shelf, but what am I? Great. I don't know. So what are the thoughts about this kind of, about influence by non-Africans and African views, or on this exchange of money? You were talking about how much the Methodist churches in Africa depend on funding from the United States. I mean, I don't want to be too critical of well-meaning sort of development projects, but I mean, does that perpetuate dependency? Is that a form of neocolonialism? Mm-hmm. How can more powerful, wealthy churches, institutions, countries, communities interact with respectfully with those that are less wealthy and powerful? I mean, can there be an interaction without some kind of,
I mean, I think in general and different mission projects, I've been involved with, you know, on this side, not travel, mm-hmm. but I think those that have been most successful, I feel, are approached with a higher level of humility mm-hmm. of, you know, we have resources, but we don't know the needs, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a very real risk of going in and having great intentions but not providing what's needed. Mm-hmm. And so I think there can be a lot of good, but mm-hmm. there can also be hurt if it's not done well.
Yeah. Or if it's not sustainable, or...
Mm-hmm.
in our context too, there are at least two of the regions that we're in relationship with have a common practice of polygamy. So like we're talking about it in terms of LGBT folks, but it's also interesting to just want like the whole economic social fabric in these regions are built around polygamous culture. And so how that plays, like right now conservative Christians in the Methodist Church are quiet about that, but you could see a day when they might not be as quiet
where,
about
where
that.
The money might come with strings attached. I should say William Wade Harris was a had several wives as part of his Africanization. Other thoughts about that? I mean, things that churches in the United States should consider when interacting with African churches? I guess are the ways to ensure a respectful relationship or empowerment.
How is this concern about how to interact with these African churches any different than how we interact with the identity politics and cultures right within our own country? And don't we see pushback in all sorts of areas of the country, and we see enormous divisions? And you see people who fall when you do studies on human growth and development and cognitive development and moral development and critical thinking. And you have people who are, it sounds like rank ordering, but who are much more advanced in terms of their critical thinking and moral development. And don't we have to kind of recognize that people are at different stages? I mean, this guy that used to, I've forgotten what his name is, but he used to work with people with addictions in New York. And he had to have a very almost patriarchal, authoritarian approach for those people to get off the streets and find some sort of community through which they could get off their addictions and begin to put their lives together. And I don't know if some of those people ever get away from that black and white kind of thinking, because if they do, they won't survive. So I think this is so complex a human problem. It's just, people who are ethnocentric right now in the country.
So obviously some of it has to do with cultural differences or different worldviews. I guess I was kind of giving a little more emphasis to the kind of disparities in wealth and power, and and what does it mean that, you know, increasing numbers of Christians are African, but may not necessarily have the wealth and power. I mean, you know, how much influence or control do European and American churches have over Christianity in Africa, whether it comes with, you know, money or...
When Hal is talking in the morning about how this patriarchy is so oppressive to women and those who aren't firstborn, and I mean, it represents a kind of significant violence and loss or at least absence of freedom, and that's so important just for people to be human beings. That I mean, it's just complex stuff you guys are dealing with.
I guess, yes, and the social scientist in me always wants to look at, okay, what are... always to try to learn more about the culture. That's been always my immediate response, you know, like with patriarchy or polygamy. It's like our immediate response is, okay, this is, you know, oppressive to women, but then you start, and I say, okay, well, what about the women who are in favor of it then, and what are their motivations in voluntarily coming into a polygamous household? And, so I think in a lot of ways there's more complexity, and I guess to answer my own question about how do those churches with more power deal with those with less power, I guess one of it is education. I think it's important just to try and learn, okay, what are their worldviews? Not just do they need malaria nets, but okay, how do they even understand malaria? What do they think about health? Just kind of understand the culture as much as possible. It seems to me, in addition to, I don't know, it's a demonstration of respect as well. Everyone should take my African history classes. Learn African languages. All right. So then, I don't know if I have anything else to say. Well, yeah, I guess we weren't talking about this. I was suggesting the final question being, I guess as I say here, Christian diversity and the unity of love. Maybe to end on a more optimistic note, I mean, I guess all the interactions I've had with African Christians and worship services that I've attended, I mean, I guess I still find a a shared sense of the gospel on so many occasions. And I wish now that I had brought along a recording of it. I mean, for me, one of the, I mean, when I was just kind of Peace Corps volunteer in my mid-20s and kind of often felt kind of lonely, and I remember every Sunday afternoon, I would always hear the Catholic Church was just like 100 yards away, and the youth group would meet every Sunday afternoon, and I still remember them singing these songs every afternoon. I just, you know, here I am very far away from my Lutheran church, whatever, and even, you know, familiar music, but they just had these beautiful songs that they would sing in Setswana, and I was like, yes, this is Christianity. That it's not just, you know, Martin Luther. It's not just Einfest the Board. There's all kinds of beauty and shared understanding of the Spirit, shared understanding of what God's grace really means in people's lives. That, in my opinion, overcomes these cultural differences and economic disparities. That I don't know how many times I've had really meaningful worship services in Africa that, even if I couldn't understand a word in some places. All right. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.